And school and clothes and food, you know.
Were you renting your house or did you own the house?
No, Granny.
Uh-huh.
She never was able to buy a home back for mom.
Tell me about your shoe shining.
Oh, yeah, shoe shining. I used to shine shoes on First and Rowan Streets, First and Soto Streets, Whittier and Euclid. I got to, when I was about 14 years old, I got enough money and I talked this guy next to the fire station there on Whittier and Euclid to let me put a shoe shine stand there. And the YMCA used to be across the street there. And used to have a lot of drugstore and bakeries and I don't know what else. And all these people became my customers. I became pretty good at shining shoes. And I used to make $1.50, $2 on weekends. And this was great for my mother, help her a little bit, you know. And I'd keep 50 cents. That was a lot of money in those days. And then on Sundays, too, I would deliver the Herald Examiner and carrying a pulling a little wagon, you know, with a delivering door to door these Sunday newspapers, make another 25, 30 cents a day, you know.
Hard working.
Huh?
Hard working.
Well, it was fun
How
'cause
did you get started with the shoe shine? What gave you the idea to start doing it?
well, I started actually shining shoes in Olive when I was about 10 years old. I used to go to this pool hall, the only pool hall in the little big downtown. The downtown was what? The hotel, the pool hall, a blacksmith shop, a grocery store, and a drugstore. That was main downtown. And on Sundays, I used to go there and or Saturdays and shine the shoes of these guys and playing pool. And I started to learn how to play, how to shine shoes. And I did some very things that I'm not too proud of, but that was part of that was I used to have a dog. His name was Shinnigan. As a matter of fact, I'm writing about him on this book. He became my friend. He wasn't mine, but he was a friend of a neighbor, and we got to be friends. And he was a huge dog, you know, and he was a mastiff, and he used to be a good fighter. And I didn't know this, but the guys at the pool hall used to tell me to get Shinnigan, and we go to Yorba Linda, we go to Fullerton, and Placentia and Tustin and all those little towns, and they'd fight Shinnigan against dog fights, you know, and they would bet, and they would give me $1 and 50 cents or something, and I'd come home with a problem with my mother, but this poor dog got beat up, and I'd have to cure him during the week, you know, but he had a terrible reputation, and he was famous in Orange County.
Wow.
Whipped dogs, you know. I didn't know this. I thought it was just fun, really. I didn't know what I was doing, you know.
That's
stupid
funny.
Things a kid does.
So then, what year did you finish high school?
I graduated in 1937.
And then, what did you do next?
Oh, I hate to say this, but in those days, anybody who thought about going to college was really way out. So I hadn't learned a thing, really. I went to school, eat my lunch, and play ball. The old saying, you know, which is true. I'm not ashamed of it. I should have gotten a good education, but I never did. And so I didn't know what to do, so I went to work painting cars or learning how to in a body shop. And that's what I did. I started working in a body shop.
And you're still living in the same neighborhood?
Yeah, still living in the same neighborhood.
So then...
I've never moved from this neighborhood. I've traveled, you know, through ABC and through the service and all that, but I never left for a long time this area.
Uh-huh.
Still here.
So when did you go? You went into the service during World War II?
Yeah.
So can you tell me about your experiences? Well, first here, what happened when the war started? Your memories of that.
One of I remember just that we were having a ball at the time. I had a good time all my young life. The big band era was around, you know, and we used to have these. Record dancers at the Fresno Playground and at Evergreen at State Playground, and people from all over different neighborhoods would come to these dances, and I became a kind of a jitterbug, you know. Yeah, 1939-40, you know, with Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw and all these big band guys, Duke Ellington, and we were very influenced by black music in those days. And I was having a ball when, there's another thing that I'm not too proud of. We got a little wild. It was during the beginning of what they call the Pachuca era, Zoot era, you know. And my mother didn't like me to dress with those tight pants. She tore a couple of my pants, you know. And but we got a little wild, and it was the beginning of the gangs in East LA. The reason I think because we were influenced, like I said, by these gangsters, and also by these guys, what they call Pachucos. Really, they're people from El Paso. That's what we interpreted it.
Hmm.
They came from El Paso to Los Angeles during the war to work. There was a lot of work in Los Angeles. And we were hicks, you know, here in L.A. compared to them. And they used to dress real sharp and have these suit and tailored clothes and dance real good. And you know, we got influenced. And they used to talk real funny, what we call calo.
Right.
We learned how to imitate them. And we started to get a lot of hand, and we were starting to get into some different fights with different neighborhoods, you know. See, East LA, now they consider anybody East LA. East LA, and when I was born, was from Main Street to Ford Boulevard. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
None of this El Sereno or, you know, it was just an area.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Belvedere and Maravilla, they called it. And in those days, it was kind of dangerous. You had to be careful going in place because if you were from East L.A., they used to, try to fight with you, jump with you. So we started getting together and saying, well, gee, we can't go anywhere because right away there's a fight, so let's band together and stick together, and that's the way it was.
Is it because of racism that people would...
Well, no, it was among the Mexican people. Okay.
So if you were from East L.A., if you went anywhere...
If we went anywhere, we went to Lincoln Heights, say, for instance. The guys from Lincoln Heights would to get mad. If we went downtown, they had to... Alpine, they had a gang called Alpine. It was during the gang area, you know. Well, gangs are bad now, but in those days it was just fist fights and just, young guys.
What was it about that? It was about neighborhood?
About neighborhoods, the way you danced, the way you dressed. And East LA had the reputation. Clanton, too, was a bad area. We couldn't go to the Shrine Auditorium or to dances or that because the guys from Clanton were there and the guys from 38th, you know. The usual. It was just the beginning of the gangs in the 30s.
Right. And you think that started with the people who came from El Paso, or that's more the...
Well, they influenced us.
The style.
They influenced our style of dress and our style of talking.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but the neighborhoods were already tight.
They were already established. East L.A. had that reputation because there, I don't know if you know, but there was a lot, in those days, boxing was very big. And most of the big name boxers came from East L.A. because of the situation, you know, the way of life. We had a lot of great boxers, and I guess these other neighborhoods would resent that, and then we would, and we dressed a little different than they. We danced a little better than most of them. They always do, and they used to cause conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Well, back to why I got into the service. We were at a dance. There had been a shooting at the Coliseum. I didn't know anything about it, but I went to this dance. They used to call it the Royal Palms. Big bands used to go there. And,
where is that?
Royal Palms Hotel.
Oh, okay.
And around the Westlake area.
Mm-hmm.
And all the neighbors used to go there. But I didn't know this. When I walked in that night, the owner says, "Be careful tonight. Don't get in a fight, you guys. There's some guys here from back east, and they're gonna arrest you." "Why?" He says, "Well, just cool and don't get in a fight." He says, "Oh." So didn't know this. That was the first night. The second Saturday, the same guy, the owner that used to make the dances, says, "Well, they're here. They're going to talk to some of you guys. So cooperate with them, okay?" Okay. So my name was on a list that they had. And they were from back, FBI people, I guess. I don't know. Never. I remember the guy's name. But anyway, I was about the fourth one called into this little office. There was four goons and they're big guys, man, with guns. And they were here to calm down the gangs fights, you know, in L.A. And they were sent here, and this Bud Young, I never forget his name, you know, Bud Young. When they called my name, and couple of my friends came out and said, "Whew, take it easy, man. Don't begin to do anything." I said, "Okay, well, I don't know what's going on." So, "Well, you'll find out right now." So when I walked into this room, this Bud Young, huge guy, man, he's got arms about this size, big hands, and he was sitting on top of this desk like this, and there was three other guys in the back just watching. And when I walked in, "Your name's Pete?" I said, "Yeah." "They call you Gato?" "Cat." And they used to call me, guys used to call me Gato and Chino because I had these mm-hmm. chinky eyes, and Gato because they said I looked like a cat. And I says, "Yeah, they call me Gato." He says, "I'm not going to fool around with you." He says, "I'm going to get right straight to business." He says, "I want to see how tough you are, how bad you are." I says, "I don't know what you're talking about." "You know what I'm talking about. I want to see how bad you are, just you and me, right now." And he had his shirt coat off and his shirt sleeve, but he had his gun still there. He said, "Just you and me. Never mind these guys still in the back. Just you and me, we'll get in a fight right now. And I want to see how bad you are." I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." He says, "You know what I'm talking about." "No, I don't know what you're talking about." "Yes, you do." He says, "Well, let me tell you this. We're going to be here for about 3 months, and you're going to see me. And if you get into any trouble or any fights, I'm going to come for you, okay? I'm going to come for you, and I'm going to kill you. We have permission to kill you. That's why the guns. You understand that, Lincoln? You know, you talk to me straight." And I said, "Wow." Scared straight. That's the name of really what it was all about, see? So he did hang around, and he became friends with us. He used to come to go to the dances and buy his drinks, and you know, we'd buy him a drink. And we find him, why don't you guys go into service? He says, that's the only way you're going to stop this. Go into service. You're young and healthy, all of you. You know, get up and get. The war's going on, and that's how I got in. That's how I enlisted. I didn't wait to get drafted with all this turmoil. I said, I better get out of here.
Was this the Army or the Navy?
Army. I went into the Army.
Mm-hmm. So what year did you go into the Army?
In 1943.
So this is prior to the Zoot Suit riots then? Or what year would that have been?
When no, this was prior to the Zoot Suit riots.
Okay.
I wasn't here when this happened. So most of us did. I'll just go and just say the heck with it, you know. And that busted up the gangs, really, for a while.
Huh. So it was a big enough problem that someone sent someone out here to do that?
Yeah.
Do you know who?
People, they were police, you could tell. They had badges, they had identification, mm-hmm. they were serious. They weren't fooling around. This is getting out of hand too much, mm-hmm. you know, so they had to do something.
Wow.
I don't know. I don't think anybody's ever talked about that.
That's very interesting.
Very interesting, it is. Unfortunately, with my bum knee, see, I enlisted in the airborne. All of us was there because we liked the uniform. You know? I was 20, I was going to be 24, 23. And before being drafted, you could, if you enlisted, you could choose your. And I talked four of my friends into going, let's go airborne, you know. Paratroopers, it was just beginning, the paratroopers, and because shiny, I used to love those shiny boots and the dresses and the way the guys looked, you know. And you know, there's a lot of Mexicans in the airborne. And I they didn't pass me airborne because of my knee. So we go to this induction center on 6th and Main Street. That's where they used to induct. And we went in for a physical. And I remember a bunch of guys. It was really, people were getting drafted and going into the service, hundreds in a day here in Los Angeles. And they separated us. They put me in one side and they put the rest of the three guys, my friends, over in one area across the hall. I said, what are you doing? I don't know what was going to happen here. But they took them all into the airborne and they put me in limited service. I'm kind of my bum knee. I wouldn't pass the physical. And they all went to the South Pacific and some went to Europe, airborne. And they put me in limited service in the post office in Fort Irwin. Can you believe that? And I got out of that too.
Do you recall when the internment of the Japanese Americans started? Because
yeah.
You must have been your neighbors.
A lot of my friends were interned.
What do you remember about that?
I remember Mike Yonai crying a lot. He gave me a big samurai sword, and he gave me two turtles, and some other stuff I forget, a bow and arrow. Jake joined the army, so I don't remember much of him. Cedric and his people, they were very refined. They owned a store on 1st and Central, I think, something around there. They had to sell that. And it was just a mess. It was just, they were wondering why they were doing this, you know.
Were you surprised when it happened?
Yeah, sure, we all were surprised. We saw, gee, wanted to go do that next to the Mexicans, you know. But I guess The hysteria at that time was that since the Japanese were seen near the coast, on the California coast, and they thought all the Japanese people that lived there were citizens, were all spies, and were all... And I'm sure there are a lot of them that were in agreement with the Japanese government on this, but the rest were just ordinary, like us, you know, they weren't spies, they were Americans, just like us. You know, it's weird.
I want to do one thing. Yeah. One moment.
Well, that was a very interesting era to me, the 40s, you know, and the World War II.
So when did you come back to L.A. and you were out of the service?
Well, I came back the same year. I was just in there not even 12 weeks because they sent me first to Fort Irwin. And then I was there 5 weeks, and then they sent me to Henderson Field in Las Vegas, in Nevada, to work in a post office. And here I am driving a Jeep back and forth to Las Vegas. Nothing. It was just a little dinky town, nothing, you know. And we used to go in there, a bunch of GIs, in the evening to horse around and fool around. But it was nothing like it is now. It's amazing to see the changes. You know? And I didn't like doing this. I was getting $32 a month, I mean, for working all day like this. It was cold, you know, in the desert. So I'm getting out of here. And I met a guy from Texas who was the same way. And he says, well, you know what? He says, we used to talk in the bunks at night. You know? I'm sorry I didn't. That's the only thing that I regret, that I didn't go to, you know, get to go to overseas with my friends. Is wrap one of these GI shoes that they give you, stiff, brand new, in a towel and pound your knee. I said, what for? He said, well, in the morning roll call, you'll be so, it'll swell up so much that you can't even walk on the stand, and then some friends of mine did it, and they'll see that you can't work or do anything, so they'll kick you out, and then you go home. So that's what I did. Can you believe that? Dumb. But I got, you know, I should have stayed, but I just didn't want to. Guys were making a lot of money out here, you know, and I wanted to get into that. Getting out $32 a month.
Yeah. So you came back to L.A., and what happened?
Came into L.A., back. I surprised my mother at 3 o'clock in the morning. They gave me $127, I think it was, for the 2 months and some little travel pay. And I went into Las Vegas and gambled it all. So I had to bump back to L.A. And it was getting dark. It says, how am I? I didn't even save money to buy the bus ticket to get home. I says, what the heck about it? So I started bumming, and I got a ride with some guy in a truck to stop. It was getting dark, and I says, geez, I wonder if I'm going to get home. And he says, well, it's getting cold, too. And I had a ride with a horse. He said, well, if you want a ride, I'm going up to Barstow. He says, I'll give you a ride up to Barstow, but you got to get him back with a horse. Because he had his wife and some kids. So I got in the back, and the horse is looking at me all the way. What am I doing in the back? And I rode all the way. Oh, it's dumb. I'm telling you, some things that I've done in my life is stupid. And I got back. Nobody was here. Everybody was gone. In the army or someplace else. So I decided, what am I going to do? I know I'm going to hang around. There's nothing here no more. And so I went up north. I went to collect my, they used to call it 50 something, $50 a week in the unemployment. No, was it 50? No, it wasn't 50, 20 something. Become a lumberjack, you know, become a lumberjack. And I said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. So I went up north. I went to the Attico to Sacramento. So they paid my way to Sacramento, and there I had to again enlist in there. they sent me to camp way out there near Oregon, and I almost caused a riot because I was in a union. I didn't know this. All these things, you know, dumb things that happen to a kid, man, you know. I almost caused the union guys came and said, well, no, you can't work here. I said, why not? I said, you can't, that's it. You don't belong to the union. Besides, they didn't have any Mexicans up there. Mm-hmm. Ah, the racism. When you talk about racism, I went through quite a bit of that. And I got out of there. I said, these guys are going to kill me, man. I got out of that camp. And I was bumming back to Sacramento when somebody picked me up. Luck again. And he was an owner of a lumber camp, Mr. Forward. Forward Lumber Company near, what was the name? Red Bluff, up there in the mountains, up north. And so he said, "You, where are you going?" I told him, Sacramento. I told him the story about the. He said, "Oh, you want to work?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I got a lumber company." So he gave me a job in his lumber company. And I worked 3 years. 3 years in there. Saved $800. It's a lot of money in those days. Good shape, you know, good, clean life. And away from all this stuff here in L.A.
So what year did you return to L.A.? Hmm? What year did you return to L.A.?
1946.
And was this getting close to when did you begin to get involved in radio?
3 years later.
Uh-huh.
3 years later, I came back to L.A. and guys were coming back. Our name was starting to get a little better, and so I started getting back in the job working painting cars. I became a pretty good painter. I had a little reputation here in L.A. for being a good painter. And my brother had started his career in Pomona, California, in radio. There was only two Spanish-language radio stations here in L.A., we never worked in Spanish-language radio. But he was an advocate of bilingualism, which was very radical in the 40s because... Mm-hmm. You know, either you spoke Spanish or you spoke English. But to use bilingual, it's brand new. He started it. And so he started his radio show in Pomona, California. It became very popular. And he came into Los Angeles to work for KMPC. And so he told me, you know, get away from that environment over there. Come with me. Learn how to do this. And he was 3 years older than me. So I started working with him. And I began to enjoy it. I began to enjoy radio. I started just bringing him the records, and he'd ask me for, and answering the phones for requests. Mexican people do that a lot. They call in for requests. Will you please play a song for my birthday on my... And the name of the show was Buenos Dias, Good Morning. And that was 6 to 7. It's amazing. I didn't know there were so many people up so early in the morning, you know what I mean? It had a great rating. He was, he became so popular that Buenos Dias became the show to hear in the mornings for people going to work.
What kind of things were on the show?
Cool. What kind of what?
Things. Was it music?
Music.
Uh-huh.
Music.
Okay.
We played music, but he was such a fun guy. And he was so totally opposite what you're supposed to be as a radio person. He said, "Oh, don't be, I'm not like these kind of disc jockeys that with a affected voice. I'm just me, plain old me." No, you know. And he used to talk to people, and they loved him. And he became called the Pied Piper of Los Angeles in the. And I began to like it so much, and hearing such great music every morning with the earplugs. See, we worked at KFVD in East Atlanta. You can imagine, this is radio station KFVD, you'll pardon the expression.
And he used to run the board. I didn't know how to run the board or anything. And I could see him. You didn't have engineers in those days. He used to run it all. Tapes here and most, not too many tapes, but reels, those big reels, and run the board and the pots and sound and all that. And I was in the next studio. And we used to laugh so much, have so much fun. We used to just laugh. It was just a joke. But I guess the people enjoyed it because we had a tremendous audience. And then we used to go. He became the first person also to get involved in the community, really involved in the community, with all kinds of things that were happening in the Mexican community. And he was always selling the second largest city of Mexicans in the world. Here in Los Angeles, and, so he had quite an audience, and he was such, and I became very popular too because I started to talk on the air with these dedications and public service announcements. You know, I liked it very much.
What kind of music did you play then?
Oh, all the old Pérez Prados and what was the name of the trio that was real? Los Panchos, Trio Los Panchos. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they the trio music and mariachi music and big band music. We even used to play Anglo music. That's what used to make it so different, you know. We used to play. What's the name of the Italian singer right now? It's real hot. We used to play Frank Sinatra. We used to play Mario Lanza. My brother used to play Mario Lanza. It was this big operatic song, and then he put on these dogs barking in the back. And he'd do these crazy things that nobody would think of doing that in Spanish radio, you know, so... So the Mexican radio disc jockeys used to pan him, and he used to pan them. And then he used to be a writer, too. So he used to write on the Belvedere Citizen, his column, Watts New, W-A-T-T-S, mm-hmm. Watts New. And he used to pan all these phony Mexican announcers. You know, you're not in Mexico, you're in America. He's very proud to be American. And it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. I became very much involved in. And then he was so ahead of his time that he was dealing already with television. And television was just beginning in the late 40s. And he became the first producer of television in Los Angeles. And I, of course, was hanging onto his tailcoats, you know, coattails. I learned how to edit film because we used to show film, Mexican movies, to the large Mexican audience here.
What channel was
KHJ.
This?
KHJ.
Okay.
It was called the Spanish Theater Hour. And then he got another program after that called Momentos Alegres. It's Happy Moments. Mm-hmm. Momentos Alegres. And there used to be a Latin variety show, and it was Pachuco Boogie and all this stuff. And we had 13 weeks on KHJ too. Eddie was something else. And he was dealing with Footcone and Belding and all these big agencies. You couldn't see any Mexican doing that. He was the only one who was doing that. And having these meetings. And then we got Fandango, which is the... It was a highly rated show here in Los Angeles. Fandango, do you know what a Fandango is? Fandango is a big Mexican party. And again, it was on CBS, KNXT. And we were on for 86 weeks on that.
What did you do on it?
Produced the show. We did variety type. I think I have some of the photos here. I don't know how many I have, but... Yeah, we had, well, that's
That was one. We still have Lalo Guerrero. He's a very famous.
This wasn't a Spanish language station anymore
no,
then.
No, CBS.
And
no.
So it was very popular at the time?
Oh, gosh. We used to have the high ratings with. We used to battle the ratings with Lawrence Welk and the Lone Ranger at 6:30 on Saturday.
What kind of guests, what other guests did you have?
Oh, we had all kinds of musical variety shows, dancers, mariachis.
That must have been so much fun.
That was fun. I learned a lot. Here's another one. I have some other, but... Yeah, it was a class show. It wasn't like this culture class nowadays. It's terrible. Some of the stuff that they're doing. Maurice O'Hara used to be a movie actor and star. And he used to do a Hamlet Ramona play. And he was very popular. But the problem was that I don't think the Mexican community was ready for anything like that because they didn't back up the show. Mm-hmm. They didn't buy the product. It was Rheingold beer. They bought it, but not enough to, you know.
It was a sponsor.
Sponsor.
Okay.
And then he went downhill after that when he was heartbroken.
Uh-huh.
He was heartbroken when he didn't have the cooperation of the people. They didn't. He was trying to tell him, look, this is the only way we're going to get into this. You have to buy the product. You can't just want a television show and not buy the product because it's not going to work. He became heartbroken and he died. But before he died, he was already into making movies. And that's how I got into to the movie industry a little bit, you know. And the man that he was producing this movie with, the Cadillac, when he passed away, told me, would you help me produce this movie? I need somebody, you know, knowledgeable in the community and can speak Spanish.
Sure.
So I helped him. Got an Academy Award nomination for that.
Tell me about the movie.
The Cadillac? The Cadillac is about a Mexican little farmer that won a Cadillac in a raffle, and it went to his head. He started to get too big shot in the community, started not liking him that much because all of a sudden here he is with a Cadillac and driving through this farming town. It's a good little movie.
Did you shoot it in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
So where did you shoot it?
Shot it in up by... Filipino farm up by Dominguez Hills.
Uh-huh.
Dominguez Hills. And then we've shot parts of it in El Monte, Ragtown, or some crummy little dump. What got the Academy Award nomination and the Academy's here was that it was done in still photo technique. It was a movie. It's a short live action subject. It isn't a big movie.
Uh-huh.
It was a short live action subject, and he did it with movie with still pictures. He shot this movie in still pictures.
Like animation.
Animation and photos, you know, still
wow.
Photos. Technique. I'm not very good technician at that stuff, but I just helped him. Get the people, get the actors, and carry cameras, and just a learning process, you know.
So
and then he got me involved in another movie called The Legend of Jimmy Blue Eyes, about a black trumpet player. And I helped him there, too. And doggone, you know, we got another Academy Award nomination? Two Academy Award nominations on two films that I've worked on. Isn't that weird? I don't know how I got into this stuff.
What are some of the memorable experiences of working on those movies?
Well, it just
getting up early in the morning and going, picking up the camera crew and loading up the trucks with all kinds of equipment and going to locations and filming all day and just actually helping him in whatever he needed, you know. It was a great experience. And I should have stayed in a little bit, but it was such a phony business. And unless you are a player, Hollywood won't pay any attention to you. You know, it's too hard. It's beginning to hit a little bit. Anyway, that experience and my... I had a lot of requests to continue with Eddie's career in radio, and I turned it down because that was his thing, it wasn't mine. And people were, come on, you know, you got a name too, and you're pretty good at this. Why don't you continue his doing radio? I got several offers. I turned them down. I turned down also after when I saw how phony Hollywood executives are. I turned that down. And I joined an organization called Justicia, Justice for Chicanos in the Motion Picture Industry. And by that time, it was already the 60s. Mm-hmm. And everybody was mad in the 60s, and that was a natural for me. That was a total natural for me. I became a total radical. Total radical. I don't know how my wife and family were able to cope with me. But,
tell me about those years.
Exciting, scary years now that I look back at stuff that I used to get into. Because we were radical. We were mad. Ray Andrade was the leader of this organization. And I think we had a dossier about that high in Washington with the President Nixon's. And, you know, I liked the man. I really, I went to his funeral. I went to, you know, but at that time we didn't like him at all. And we just raised heck with all the industry.
How? Tell me, give me an example.
Movie industry and the television industry. Ray Andrade was a Vietnam veteran. He was a recipient of the Silver Star, Bronze Star, and up for the Medal of Honor. And I don't know if you know, but Mexicans, well, they call them Hispanics. I don't like the word Hispanics, but Hispanics, because we're not Hispanic, you know, are the most decorated people, soldiers in either both World War II and Vietnam. They are. History and records show it, but if you look at any of the movies, mm-hmm. you don't see any of that, or you see any of the documentaries, you don't see any of that. I just, you know, just saw D-Day. I have mm-hmm. A friend of mine right across the street, a neighbor, was wounded in Normandy. He was blood. They didn't show a one Mexicano in there at all. Not a one. And we have more Medal of Honor recipients, more Purple Heart, Silver Stars, Bronze Stars, than any other ethnic minority. But you don't see that. Mm. You don't see that. Anyway, all this turned him off.
Ray
Andrade. And he formed this organization to, because he was offered to act in a job. He was a ranger, airborne ranger, to act in the John Wayne movie. What was it? Green Berets. And he accepted it, but he says when he got to work, he saw all this phony, and he, including John Wayne, he says, "Oh no, I don't know." But they hired him as a technical advisor. So when he got through with that film, he says, "No, this is bullshit. Excuse me, this is crap." I said, "I don't have nothing to do with this." And they kept after him because, as an ex-boxer, for some reason, Anglo-Americans and the white establishment like gutty guys.
And he was a gutty guy. And his big mustache, you know, in the 60s, right? Big, huge mustache, red hair, red, long hair, and a combat jacket all the time. And he used to tell them off right to their face. And tell them off, and then just, you want to see violence? You know, right to the point. And he used to be a good writer, so he used to have, he got a couple of guys to write proposals to him, for him. And he formed this non-profit organization that I tell you called Justice, which is a, what is it, acronym for Justice for Chicanos in the Motion Picture and Television Industry. And I joined him. I joined the organization. And we became very close. And we confronted all the major television studios, all the guilds, the director guilds, the writers guilds, screen actors, and the whole bit for during the mid-60s to 72.
Uh-huh. And what were some of your demands? Or?
Well, we made a lot of demands. We made a lot of demands that they'd stop stereotyping the Mexican as sleeping under a cactus and lazy and no good and worthless and treacherous and killers and, you know,